Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with what could be bluster or a real threat from North Korea, who warned today that foreigners should evacuate the South for their own security. Kyung Moon Hwang, who is professor of history at the University of Southern California and author of A History of Korea, joins us to discuss whether bellicose rhetoric could be matched by belligerent acts as the threats of war coming from the North continue to escalate. Then we'll examine what gun control bill before the Senate is likely to proceed to a vote, as both President Obama and Majority Leader Harry Reid made impassioned pleas to Republicans to allow for a vote and give up on their filibuster threats. Joshua Horwitz, who is the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea, joins us to discuss whether something positive will happen in this critical week for gun safety. Then finally, we'll speak with Eric Kingston, the founding co-director of Social Security Works and the co-chair of the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, about the petition of 2.3 million signatures that his organization and Democracy for America handed over to the White House today. We will discuss the objections progressives have to the chained CPI adjustment to Social Security payments that the president is apparently offering up in his budget, even though the Republicans seem prepared to dismiss it out of hand. Joining us now is Kyung Moon Hwang, who is professor of history at the University of Southern California. His book, A History of Korea, came out in 2010, and he's also the author of Beyond Birth, Social Status in the Emergence of Modern Korea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kyung Moon Hwang.
Thank you very much.
And there's been, of course, warnings and threats from the North, and warnings as well as the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warning that the crisis on the Korean Peninsula could become uncontrollable. There was a report coming out from Pyongyang's Asia-Pacific Peace Committee today that said the situation on the Korean Peninsula is heading for a thermonuclear war. In the event of war, we don't want foreigners living in South Korea to get hurt. And they went on to urge all foreign organizations, companies, and tourists to work out measures for evacuation. So I guess the first question is, what's the authority behind Pyongyang's Asia-Pacific Peace Committee, and is this something that we should be concerned about?
I don't really know what the authority is behind that so-called peace committee. I imagine that it's simply another mouthpiece for the state up in North Korea. The bigger question is whether we should be concerned about this. Of course, we should be concerned about this. I personally don't see a great difference between these expressions of hostility and previous expressions of hostility, which have come almost in a cyclical manner and timed in accordance with the military exercises that take place every year with the United States and South Korea. And so perhaps the intensity level has gone up a bit this year, and the very specific suggestions of what might happen are at a level that we haven't seen recently. But I think it's really a matter of difference in degree than in kind. And I think a lot of it has to do with, and perhaps even most of it has to do with, the politics within North Korea surrounding the solidification or the attempt to solidify his rule on the part of the new and very young ruler in North Korea. And so it's difficult to really separate out the special qualities or the inequalities of this round of hostilities from what has happened so often in the past.
Well, the Secretary General of the UN also called for the Kaesong Industrial Complex to be kept open, calling it one of the most successful cooperative projects between the South and the North. And today, North Korean employees did not report for work. And as you know, a few days ago, the South Korean employees were forbidden entry. So given that how important that's been in terms of making money for the North, it's that in itself is an escalation, isn't it? I mean, this has been going on even when they've done, for example, when they sunk the warship and when they shelled the islands, they didn't close that Kaesong complex.
Yeah, in that sense, it is somewhat of a departure. I would remind everybody, though, that this is not something that has been established or in place for a long, long time. It's I don't know exactly how many years ago it was, but it was not something that dates back to earlier decades and earlier periods in the history of the two Koreas. And if it had been, I think we probably would have seen more instances of threats of shutting something like this down, or the actual shutdown of this venture that's supposed to represent, of course, communication and reconciliation to the extent that's possible. As far as the economic impact, I'm not really sure how really significant this is to North Korea. That's something that other people, I think, might have better figures on. I actually don't know much about the specific value of this venture, either to the North Koreans or to the South Korean businesses. Yeah.
I think it's in the hundreds of millions at the most, compared to the $5 billion in trade that North Korea does with China. It's probably not that significant.
Right, and I think we have to remember that in North Korea, everything is filtered through the state, and everything ultimately is an expression of what is going on within the state. And it seems that for the moment and for the past 1.5 years, that the primary occupation of the state authorities in the north has been to solidify the ruling order that's been manufactured based on this hereditary succession of the Kim family. And so the person who's in there right now, he is now two generations removed from the undisputed founder and great leader of North Korea. And so he's two generations removed from that legitimacy that was endowed upon his grandfather. And so he has more work to do in order to make up that gap. And I think given that he was not prepared to take this role, especially compared to his father, who was publicly in the position of being the next leader for over a decade, this person was relatively quickly brought in from the cold, in a sense, and made the successor only about 2 or 3 years before he actually took that position. And so everything is being, I think, somewhat intensified in the process of strengthening his legitimacy and solidifying his grip over the North Korean regime.
Well, apparently the oldest son was a bit of a playboy and liked to gamble in Macau. So he was overlooked for the current leader. But on April the 15th, which is coming up soon, that is Kim Il-sung, the great leader that you just mentioned. That's his birthday.
That's correct,
called the Day of the Sun. It's a huge national holiday.
The biggest holiday, yeah.
So that's their Christmases and New Year's all wrapped in one. Do you think anything's going to happen on that day?
I'm sure something is going to happen on that day, something probably fairly provocative from that, at least from the perspective of the outside world. From the perspective of the inside world, again, it's simply a matter of playing to this game of reinforcing the legitimation narrative of the current ruler and by extension, the legitimation narrative of the Kim family as a whole. And so the more you can remind other North Koreans, the North Korean people, in other words, of this connection between the current ruler and the great founder of the country, the thinking is that the more that's going to solidify his grip on power. And so you can expect enormous fireworks, literally, as well, on April 15th. And I'm really glad you mentioned that, because from a historical perspective, that's what really dictates a lot of what's going on. And not only the April 15th date, but in general, this need to perpetuate the narrative that's been fabricated about the legitimacy of the Kim family. Last year, I was actually in Korea on the 100th anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birth, April 15th, 2012, which in the North Korean dating system, of course, is 100, year 100, actually it's the year 101, depending on how you measure it. Anyway, that was, because it was a centennial, it was the biggest state in North Korea in many, many, many years. And it seems like the Western media completely missed that aspect of it, and we focus mostly on the nuclear test and the rocket launch, the satellite launch, and I forgot exactly what else. But all of this really was first and foremost an expression of the legitimation narrative and celebrating the 100th birth date of Kim Il-sung. On April 15th, 2012, last year, in fact, in the West, we all remember that as the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, which interestingly fell on the same date in 1912. In North Korea, you know, they don't know about or couldn't care less about the Titanic, and yet for them it's a much bigger anniversary and date than it is for people in the West who remember the Titanic. So I thought that was kind of interesting, this junk between the two.
So, again, I'm speaking with Kyung Moon Hwang, who's professor of history at the University of Southern California. His book, A History of Korea, came out in 2010, and he's also the author of Beyond Birth, Social Status and the Emergence of Modern Korea. So in terms of the narrative, my understanding, though, is that the founder of modern North Korea, Kim Il-sung, was basically put in place by the Soviet Army, and he served in the Red Army, they basically constructed the narrative, these Russian colonels, essentially. Is that that they decided, because he didn't have the legitimacy that they needed, they decided to elevate him in that cult leader way that Stalin, who was in power at the time, enjoyed.
No, I'm not sure that's exactly correct. That's a bit more complicated than that. He did have a bit of legitimacy in the sense that he was well known from the late 1930s as this communist guerrilla leader who fought against the Japanese in Manchuria. And so rumors had spread about his being able to evade the Japanese hunt for him. And he ultimately did become really the only person who was able to lead a guerrilla campaign successfully in terms of not being caught. And by the time we get to 1940, 41, he also saw the writing on the wall, and he escaped to the Soviet Union. He stayed in hiding there until he returned to Northern Korea, literally riding the trucks of the Soviet occupation, which came in after Korea's liberation from Japanese rule. And the Soviets did place him in that position. They weren't necessarily inclined to do so at first, but he kind of became the de facto person. And it was partly because he had this trail of legitimacy based on his independence fighting reputation. And so that wasn't completely manufactured. What was manufactured thereafter was not really a Soviet invention as much as it was a North Korean state invention or a Kim Il-sung invention about how he was the one who liberated Korea, how he's the one who beat back the Americans in the Korean War, how he saved the country from American-led destruction of North Korea. And layer upon layer of these historical fabrications, really, they were not the result of any kind of Soviet action as much as it was a part of the legitimation narrative of the North Korean regime, and more specifically the Kim family.
So, Kyung Moon Hwang, back to the current tensions, and I spoke recently with former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea and former CIA station chief there, Donald Gregg, who was quite alarmed at what he felt the White House was falling into the old narrative of regime change are going to happen, the kid's never going to make it, you can't reward bad behavior, all that same stuff that went on with George W. Bush. And he thought that was ridiculous and dangerous. And he also said when he was ambassador, he canceled the military exercises. If these military exercises weren't going on now, would we have this rhetoric and ratcheting up the war threats from the North if there was no excuse provided by the United States and South Korea?
I doubt it. I doubt that it would have happened this way. I doubt the intensity level would have even approached what it has approached. And the really ironic thing about all this is that this stance by the American government, this show of belligerence, if you want to call it that, or hostility or this show of fortitude. This actually plays into the hands of the North Korean regime, and they benefit from having this easy fruit to pick in terms of using it as another reason to lather up the population in this anti-American hate fest or hate session. It's straight out of Orwell, frankly. And so it really strengthens, ultimately, the North Korean regime's goals by being so easy to pick upon through this show of force on the part of the American military.
So just in closing then, Kyung Moon Hwang, do you Ambassador Don Gregg was saying was that all the North wants, and he's in contact with them, they just want to talk. You know, that's what Dennis Rodman said. You know, he just wants the White House to call him. I mean, it sounds sort of somewhat trivial, but is that what it really comes down to?
You know, I'm not really in a position to address that. I have no idea what ultimately the Northern regime wants as far as the immediate relationship with the United States or with South Korea. I mean, it's difficult to fathom that they would be this hostile without the military exercises. And on the other hand, you have to think that the Northern regime is aware that anything that would lead toward greater economic aid to the country would be beneficial. And so they might be stuck in between a rock and a hard place as well. On the one hand, they want to take advantage of this opportunity created by the military exercise. On the other hand, they don't want to go so far that they would shut the door to any future negotiations that would ultimately benefit them economically. And so it's a difficult position, I imagine, that the Northern regime itself is in.
Well, their main sponsor, if you will, or at least protector, is China. And the new president, Xi Jinping, on the southern Chinese island of Hainan, meeting with some foreign visitors, said no one should be allowed to throw a region or even the whole world into chaos for selfish gains. So that would indicate that that the North has irritated China.
Of all things, this is something new. Maybe this is the really interesting part of the latest round of saber rattling, that the new Chinese regime, has maybe taken a different stance than what previous Chinese regimes have. And it's quite striking because they have apparently this blood bond based on the Chinese assistance to North Korea during the Korean War, which essentially saved North Korea from oblivion when the Chinese intervened in late 1950. I just spoke about this, in fact, in class today to my students because we're covering the Korean War. This blood bond that apparently was forged at that time perhaps is weakening, or maybe it's the generational shift in the Chinese leadership that has determined that the blood bond is no longer so thick anymore. It's really striking.
Well, Kyung Moon Hwang, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Kyung Moon Hwang, who is professor of history at the University of Southern California. His book, A History of Korea, came out in 2010, and he's also the author of Beyond Birth, Social Status in the Emergence of Modern Korea. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about whether or not there's going to be anything positive coming out of this critical week for gun safety on Capitol Hill.